Good afternoon and welcome to Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy. My legal expert and co-host Elaine Andrews had a recent scheduling conflict and can't be with us for this edition. Our topic today is the juvenile justice system in Alaska and ways that it differs from the adult criminal justice system. Tons of research shows that the adolescent brain continues to mature well into the 20s, yet children and teens still commit crimes and break the law. How do we as Alaskans handle that? What accommodations do we make for immature judgment, impulsive behavior, or even children reacting to sexual or physical abuse and trauma? This is a complicated area, and here to help us understand Alaska's juvenile justice landscape are three guests. I have Heather Nobrega, an Anchorage prosecutor who often handles juvenile cases. Welcome, Heather.
Thank you.
Really glad to have you here. Thank you. We also have John Burnitz, a public defender who almost always handles juvenile cases. Am I right?
That's true. Thank you for letting us be here.
I'm glad to have you. And then we have Heidi Reddick, Chief Probation Officer for the Division of Juvenile Justice.
Thank you for the Anchorage region.
For the Anchorage region. Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's be specific. So welcome to you all. I also want to tell folks we've got on our website at alaskapublic.org a couple of links that you might find useful. We've got a link to the Division of Juvenile Justice, which has a lot of data. So if you're curious about numbers, you can go there and read that. I also have a link to the Galt case, which you're going to hear about a little bit later. I've got Wikipedia, but we have an expert here who's going to talk about it, and it has something to do with juvenile justice. And just a couple of other things that you might want to take a look at if you get interested in this conversation. And also, we do invite you to call in if you like. If you have questions about juvenile justice or an experience you want to share, we welcome that. You can call us in Anchorage at 550-8433. Statewide, it is 1-888-353-5752. And we can also take your email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. Okay, so to get started, I just thought we are somewhat prompted to have the show because there was this, 1967 case called the Galt case. So I'm looking at John because he's a public defender and knows a lot about it. And why don't you just lay a little bit of groundwork so people know why that was a significant case with respect to juvenile justice?
Thank you, Kathleen. I had the pleasure of meeting Gerald Galt at a conference, and at that time, I don't know how old he is now, but he's definitely in his 70s. It's many years ago, about 4 years ago, and when he talked about this incident,
Who was he? Was he the lawyer, or was he?
He's N. Ray Galt. He's the person that the case was about in regards to Galt.
He was the subject of it.
Subject of the case, and before maybe 1,200 people, he still cried about this. So here's the story very briefly. He was he had a little bit of trouble. He made a crank phone call. He was caught making the crank phone call. He was taken to juvenile court. His parents weren't noted. His mother didn't know where he was. After a couple hearings, in which weren't really hearings, nothing was recorded. There was no lawyer. I don't know if his parents are present. I think his parents are present for some of them, but not all of them. The judge sentenced him to reform school until his majority, which was 21. He was 15 at the time. So he got 7 years for a crank phone call. And then the court, there was no appeal. So what they had to do is do a different legal process. But through the legal process, the United States Supreme Court said, you can't do that. You have to give people their rights. The idea had been that the state was like the parent, was like Gerald's parents. And so they could do whatever they wanted. In the same way, you can give your kid a timeout. And the state could do that. And you didn't really need to have due process rights. They threw that out because they said it didn't really work. And this is an example of a case where it didn't work. So now because of that case, kids are get lawyers, they get a right to remain silent, they get a right to appeal, they get notice of the hearings have to be recorded, they get all the due process rights that they should have gotten.
And the year of that was 1967, right? I mean, yes. It doesn't seem like that long ago.
No, May 15th.
Yeah. Yeah.
Happy and Ray Galt
Day. Oh, that's
Day.
Right. And today is May 17th, and that was May 15, 1967. So
right.
That's a little bit about one of the reasons that we've got the show today. Heather, as a prosecutor, is there anything you want to add to that, or did he cover what needs to be said at this point?
I think he covered the gist of that this is how we got to where the juvenile justice system is today.
Mm-hmm. So then I'm turning to Heidi, Chief Probation Officer for the Anchorage area. Could you just lay out the landscape? Because a lot of people might know that McLaughlin is a youth facility of some sort, but really, we don't know very much about juvenile justice. So how big is this? How many facilities do we have? Maybe you can help us out with the numbers of young men and young women who are in the system. Maybe a little bit about race, the breakdown there. Just very general, but so we get a picture of the juvenile justice system here.
Okay, great. So you're right. NYC is one of seven facilities.
Which NYC is McLaughlin
Youth. McLaughlin Youth Center is one of seven facilities that we have statewide. All of those facilities both provide detention, and some of them also provide treatment beds with them. And essentially, the difference being detention is where kids are detained while they're pending their cases, whether it be new charges or if they're already involved in probation, while we're looking at what options they have based on what's going on with their behavior and their environment and et cetera. And along with those, we also some of them have treatment beds provided in them. And these are for kids that need that more restrictive setting that maybe didn't make it in lesser restrictives, because we are a system that is based in treating at the lesser restrictives, trying keeping them community-based, residential-based, or even at home. And so, but there is a small percentage of those kids that sometimes end up needing that. And so some of our facilities provide that. Across the state, we have 15 probation offices that also work with the kids in community and also are the ones that handle the cases that are going through the formal court system. And I guess that's the biggest, you know, wanting people to understand that when we get into these conversations about the formal court action that Ms. Heather and John will be talking about is that of the referrals that we get from law enforcement, about 80% of them never see the inside of a courtroom. We handle
Because what happens?
Because we're able to handle those through diversion processes. We get in and the probation officers get their feet on the ground, go work with the families, you know, kind of figure out maybe what needs some help and some support to get people back on, get people and families, kids and families back on track. And we try and offer that, connecting them to services. It might be that, you know, they come and see us, you know, on a weekly basis. And so there's all different diversion tactics. And we have quite a few diversion programs across the state that help us with that. And so people have heard of youth courts, and we're doing some work with the tribal courts across the state. And you know, trying to get, you know, the idea is to keep them out of these facilities we're all going to be talking about,
right,
and get them better sooner. And to answer your, just a quick question on your numbers, is that as of today, We have 66 kids that are in detention across the state and 96 kids that are in our treatment facilities. We have about 1,000 youth that are on probation, some kind of services through probation.
So they might be at home.
They might be
in a foster family.
Foster home, placed with a relative, in some sort of residential treatment facility. Really a good variance of those
kids. So when you say 66 in detention, is that essentially behind bars in a way, even if it's a juvenile facility?
We're kind of away from the bars, but they are their most secure units, yes.
Okay.
We do have 66 statewide.
So pretty small number in that.
Pretty small number for what you're talking about with the size of state that we have,
right,
and some of that. And so, yeah, a vast majority never see that. So when we get into these conversations, we are just talking about 20% of the kids that people hear that get involved with us, where the 80% we can try and treat in the community.
And when I met you upstairs, you and I were chatting, and I said, are you more like a social worker than a police officer? And you said you are a peace officer, but you do an awful lot.
By title, probation is a peace officer, but absolutely, we're case managers, we're connecting them, all the things that social workers also do. John may disagree with some of that, but we really are there, you know, to work with the youth and families and look at the accountability model and restoring the community and where restorative justice program, and kind of that extra, I see it as a mentor at times, but other times they do take on other roles that that are more accountability-based than social work-based.
So we have a caller, and generally we like to welcome them and find out what their question is. So I'm going to welcome Don onto Justice Alaska. Hi, Don. What is your question?
Hi. You may want to welcome me once you hear my question. I'm divorced. I know some other people have gone through similar situations. I've gotten some updates on some laws in the process. I understand that the primary guideline is supposed to be the concern and welfare of the child. My main concern has been with some of the stuff indicating that the parents are not being notified when the kids are being interviewed, interrogated, whatever you want to call it, by various officials that come in, usually through the school. I was told this procedure had stopped years ago. Unfortunately, I bumped into somebody within the last year who says it is still going on. And I think it's a disgrace when
okay.
you teach Americans
okay.
about.
Don, let's just... So you've heard of incidences. I'm going to turn to John Burnett, a public defender. What can you say to Don about that?
Hi, Don. Thanks for calling. All right. So it is the practice in Alaska now that the police officers, the choice about whether the child wants to have their parents present is up to the child. That's based on some what I think are old cases. I don't think it's the right law or should be the right law, but that is the practice now. So that, for example, a cop or a police officer will talk to a child and say, you know, we're going to talk to you about this embarrassing crime, maybe in concern of touching your girlfriend or your non-girlfriend, and do you want your parents present? Do you want your mother there? And the child almost always says no and then talks to the police officer. I don't think it's a proper practice. And I also have had cases where oftentimes officers will go to schools to talk to children at schools because they can talk to them individually. The trend, and actually this is appropriate for In re Galte, is that lawyers should be present. I mean, some states, they have lawyers present whenever police officers are talking. They don't give the kid a choice. So there's no chance for the police officer, in my opinion, manipulating the situation and making sure that they get the statement from the kid without the parents present. So thank you for asking that, Don.
What year was that Galt case that you cited at the beginning of the program?
It's called In re, meaning re, I mean, regards to Galt, and it's 1967. I have the legal site. No.
That's what I thought I heard, but I wasn't sure. Because.
And Don, we have a link to the little Wikipedia article about that that kind of gives you a quick rundown on our website at alaskapublic.org, or just go to Wikipedia and Google Galt, and it'll pop up.
Well,
so thank you.
I'd stay off
than
that.
All right. Thanks, Don, for participating. We appreciate it. Okay. I wanted to get back to Heather. I was going to turn to you as a prosecutor. How might a juvenile find his or her way into the juvenile justice system?
So there's a variety of ways that a juvenile can become involved in the system. Most likely it involves some kind of report made to the Anchorage police regarding whether it's a theft, whether it's an assault at home on a sibling or a parent, or if there's some issues at school. So, you know, our schools have school resource officers. So those are Anchorage Police Department officers who might help kind of look into what's happening with the kid, figure out, you know, if there's any issues going on, and refer the case to the department. So there are two ways that a kid can end up at McLaughlin. That's either an officer interviews them, works the case, decides that they're going to give them a directive to contact McLaughlin, which is kind of like a traffic ticket sort of in a way. You know, you get a traffic ticket that says, hey, you need to go to court on this date. This is for juveniles that says, hey, you and your parents need to contact McLaughlin and talk to them about what should be happening next. And that's how a lot of the informal cases arise, is they're referred through the department, through APD, or university police or airport police. We have, and troopers, we have all kinds of law enforcement here in Anchorage. And then McLaughlin will decide, they'll get the police reports, they'll look at the case, they'll talk to the family and kind of figure out what's the best course of action. Sometimes when it's a pretty violent offense, or if it involves domestic violence in the homes, Anchorage police will call McLaughlin and ask if the kid should be brought down to the facility or not, and McLaughlin will make that decision. And McLaughlin will know the history of the kid. If they have an ongoing history of referrals for a particular juvenile, they'll look at that and make, you know, there's a lot of things that go into the decision about whether or not someone should be detained. And by detained, I mean brought down to McLaughlin and formally by the Anchorage police and processed then at McLaughlin. But so those are kind of the general ways that the youth become involved in the system. It definitely varies, but every incident's different. And I think that the law enforcement try to work really hard with McLaughlin to make the best decision at the time with the information they have.
Mm-hmm. So I was thinking about, you know, underage drinking or truancy or something like that. I remember reading status offenses are things that wouldn't be a crime if an adult did them, but they are considered a problem if an underage person does them. And would somebody ever end up in jail because they didn't go to school?
I don't believe we arrest kids anymore for truancy. The underage drinking, the minor consuming laws have changed, and now those are like a traffic ticket. Those are a citation and release, and you come to basically traffic court for those. But one thing I also want to make clear, which maybe people don't understand, is there are certain offenses under the statute that doesn't matter what your age is, and they're mainly traffic related, you will be charged in regular court. If you're under the age of 21, but you're drinking and driving, you will be charged as
an adult. Because it's just serious.
Correct. It's traffic-related offenses, but there is a number of statutes of offenses where the legislature has said, if you're drinking and driving, you go to regular court. If you are driving without a valid license or your license has been suspended, you will go to regular court. Mm-hmm. And then there's also a subset of crimes that are the very severe crimes. We're talking unclassified felonies and Class A felonies, where if you're 16 and older, you could be charged in the adult system versus the juvenile justice system. Mm-hmm. So there are some, obviously, exceptions to the rule. As with any rule, practically, there's exceptions. So those are some of the exceptions and some of the differences that people may not be aware of.
Okay.
But can I add one thing to that?
Yes, please.
But it's Heidi. Not to say that once kids are already placed on a probation order, they've had their offense, they've gone to a disposition phase, which is another term for sentencing, we call it disposition in juvenile land, that those kids that are on probation, official probation with the court, could end up in one of our facilities based on not going to school, using alcohol, you know, doing those status type offenses. And I think that's what John was speaking to when we were discussing earlier, is there is status offense. They're status in nature in that they're probation violations, but we try and just change the view of what's going on, put more services in there, get them back out when they're doing that. But it's looking at that total picture that has been investigated by the court and our agencies, and, you know, agreements have been made that those kids may need that intervention. Mm-hmm. But we also, you know, try and get them back out again as quick as we can.
Mm-hmm. So, John, I want to turn to you and say, you're a parent. Maybe a police officer brings your child home to the front door, and I don't know, maybe they've done something that is serious enough to at least get the police officer engaged. I'm trying to get at, when does that young person need a lawyer, or when would you say it would be good if they had a lawyer?
They would have a lawyer at the initial police contact. The police should not be able to contact my kid without them having a lawyer. I mean, if you're in an emergency situation or they can't do that.
A danger of some sort. Yeah.
But before they ever are talking to my child, I absolutely want them to have a lawyer. And actually, my kids know to say that when the police stopped them when they were kids, to say that if not that that happened, but if it was going to happen, that they should ask for a lawyer. But both of their parents are public defenders, so that's a little bit different household.
They're being raised a certain way, certain mindset.
But it's not. You know, how do I put this? There's actually one of the things, the 50th anniversary of GAL is a big deal across the nation. And one of the things that the National Juvenile Offender Center is doing is publishing this thing called Access Denied, which talks about when kids have lawyers, and is a summary across the nation of when they have. Some states do it right. It's like a competency issue. I mean, you all know that you can get your kid to say pretty much anything with the right thing. And that's what happens with police officers. They're used to doing that. They're trained to do that. It's appropriate, I think, sometimes for them to push people to get the truth of those crimes. But it's not appropriate when you're dealing with a child. And so that's what other states have found, that, you know, in that case, the kid has to be talked to a lawyer, has to have a lawyer. The kid can't waive their right to be silent and talk to a police officer unless they've been advised by a lawyer first. Does that answer your question? I'm not sure if that's where you're going.
You know, I think so. I mean, if you want to revisit it later, we can do that. I'm just going to throw our numbers out there again and remind folks who we're talking to today. This is Justice Alaska, and we have a prosecutor, Heather Noberga, with us, John Burnitz from the Public Defender's Office, and Heidi Reddick, who's a chief probation officer with the Division of Juvenile Justice in the Anchorage region, South Central region, I guess. And if you've got questions, give us a call at 550-8433 in Anchorage or 1-888-353-5752. And we can take an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. Okay, we do have a couple of questions here. Let me throw this out at you. This came in over email. Why don't we teach high school students that their brains do not finish developing until their mid-20s. Of course, this is critical with juvenile justice, right? You want to jump on that, Heidi? I mean, we know that.
Sure. And our division has done a lot of work on that over the years, both in training our staff, working in our facilities, and doing that with our parents. And fortunately, I think the message is finally getting out across the, you know, across everywhere, but that is part of a prevention mode that we'd like to be in, and with everything on the table, we're always looking at that. And so the idea of it being taught in high schools would be good, along with everything else.
Yeah.
But it is an important topic.
The kinds of things it means, like impulsive behavior or not making good choices, or, I mean, that's what we're talking about by the undeveloped brain. Anything mm-hmm. else anybody wants to add about that?
I think kids also, depending on their age and their maturity level, are very easily influenced by older kids, and maybe only a couple years older, but, you know, an 18-year-old is an adult, and an 18-year-old can be off committing offenses and bringing his 15-year-old and 17-year-old friends with them and is, you know, getting them in trouble, when that person, while slightly older, obviously it can exert influence on them. So I think it's one thing, definitely, that some are way more, swayed by the influences of their peers. And it would be nice if we could teach some kind of, you know, be careful who your friends are class.
This is what's happening in your brain. Yeah. This is your brain on adolescence.
Choose right? your friends wisely class.
Right, right. Because I'm sure you've seen cases where the influence of a friend is the first step down a path that they wish they hadn't taken.
It's definitely peer influence. It's also a unique ability to not appreciate the consequences or the consequences of the risk, and then also combined with excitement about risk. So there's an attraction to risk and not knowing what the consequences, and this is all from United States Supreme Court cases that recognize development over the past like 15 years now.
Right.
The juvenile brain is not finished until 24 to 26, I think is the numbers. And kids should know that. They know that they're smart, but it doesn't mean that their brains would be finished if they were educated that way. I mean, they're still developing. So you're never going to be able to, it's not going to stop or make them safer or take less risk or understand the consequences of the action if you tell them this.
They still have to grow up.
Yes, exactly.
They're teenagers. They already think they know everything
right.
already.
Right, right. That's true, too.
And then also that they're invulnerable, that nothing bad will ever really get them, right? So that's the one really unique thing about, I mean, you can have adults that are very immature, too, but at least we can say it's developmental for teenagers. And so that's why the system makes so many efforts at redirection and support.
Education.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Substance abuse education.
Yeah. And having programs out there, just generally speaking, that can help address that issue and have more supervision for kids of those older ages, because that's when we start to lose them. Sometimes we're losing them because they're stepping out of their own home life for whatever the reason may be, good, bad, or otherwise. But finding those other mentors out there that then can bounce them back into some supervision.
A big brother, big sister maybe, mm-hmm. or something mm-hmm. like that. Let's see, just in the landscape picture, do you know the ages, the typical ages? I know we serve up to 18 in the juvenile justice system, right?
Actually, on some occasion, we can serve up to 20.
If something is initiated before their 18th birthday, is that right?
There are certain types of crimes that that can end up having them stipulate until 20.
Okay.
The more horrendous unclassified felonies.
But right. You're right. The crime has to start before right. they're 18.
Yes.
If it starts after they're 18, they're in the adult system.
Mm-hmm.
They just can provide services. I hesitate to use that word, but yeah. They can still be in the juvenile justice system until they're 19 mostly, but with in some crimes with their consent until 20.
Right, right. And I saw that the numbers go down to like 12 and 13-year-olds, but I'm assuming that that's a very small number. I mean, where we're generally up at the 15 to 17 and 18-year-old is really the bulk of the group.
That is the bulk of the group. We do receive referrals, depending on what law enforcement decides to send over. Uh-huh. We have other ways and opportunities to look at those cases. We've seen them as young as 10 or 11. It's rare, but it occurs. And in those cases, we sort of look into them to see if there's anything we can add or provide that would not include a court choice. It might be referring them to services, helping the family with whatever they may have going on, referring them to other agencies mm-hmm. that are more appropriate than ours,
mm-hmm.
Because John, I'm sure, can speak to the competency at that age. Mm-hmm. But we do get law enforcement agencies that send those referrals, and if we think we can help with an intervention, we do try that.
Mm-hmm. So I want to make sure we're not losing the kids for the numbers here.
Okay.
You know, I had a client, God, I don't remember how old he was. I haven't had a client under 11, so he was 11, 12, 13. And he had a short arm. He was missing his upper arm. He was a deformed. He had a hand. He probably weighed about 75, 80 pounds. Because of regulations, which are appropriate, he had to be in handcuffs, shackled at certain times. But they didn't have anything that would fit, right? So because it's all too big and it's too small. So what they did is they put a couple handcuffs together, the smaller ones, so they could reach his arm connected to his shoulder, the forearm connected to the shoulder to the other hand. So, you know, you see this stuff and there's these numbers and it's incredibly dramatic. It's sad, it's dramatic, and there are real people behind each one of these numbers. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I do agree with Heidi. I think that, you know, especially for the younger kids, it's just like you can feel it with the staff there. No one wants them in prison. No one wants them in jail. And the services, I said that before, the services, you know, that's a good way to put it. I like using it because then they don't feel bad about themselves. But really, it's a locked facility. You know, it's a beautiful facility. It's airy, at least McLaughlin is, or the boys unit. But it's still jail. I mean, they're locked. They can't get out. They have to ask where they can cross from one place to the other. They have to wear the different clothes. And so
it's constricted. Yeah.
Yeah, it's very, I mean, the word they use, which also doesn't sound like it means anything, is structured. There are many rules, and they have to follow them. And if they don't follow them, they get consequences from mm-hmm. them. Mm-hmm. So I just want to make sure that people understood that it's, you know, it's both a hopeful place in that I think the staff, in my experience, unlike adult jails, but the staff seems to really care about the kids. But there's some tragedies and, you know, there's things like restraining kids. They have to hold them down. They're trained to do that. And when we're talking about really young kids, it's just very, I mean, say it again, very sad and very dramatic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I know some of the reading I did talked about kids in juvenile justice systems. And these might be people who are not behind bars or, you know, whatever you want, in detention, but are getting some kind of support or, you know, monitoring or a probation officer or something like that. But that mental illness is pretty high in this group. And I mean, I think you see that in the adult population. A lot of people in jail with mental disabilities and problems end up in jail because we really don't have the facilities for them. So I just throw that out there. It's probably, Heidi, something you deal with more than, say, the prosecutor or the defense, the mental health.
So a lot of that, there definitely is mental health through a lot of that. And we do have mental health clinicians on staff at NYC and working within our probation department and a lot of that. Certainly not always ever enough, but we try and use them for those purposes. But it is an ongoing issue. Mm-hmm. But the state of Alaska, you know, does, I think, a really good job at trying to make sure that happens if we can, you know, if we can have the people be present and the families participate. But again, there's those tough cases that both Heather and John get involved of finding that fix for them when they've fallen out of all the other systems. Mm-hmm. And sometimes quite for good reasons. They're assaulting other kids and other staff and other facilities. And John's right there. It's not a fun thing to do at McLaughlin. And we do have a wide range. Mm-hmm. But we, you know, at this point, we do assessments. We help look for treatment and do what other people have maybe already tried to do for them or the parents have tried to do themselves or,
do it again.
You know, social workers or referrals from, you know, other community agencies. And we try and just team up with them and re-engage in all of that. But it is a substantial issue in our state.
We're going to take a break in just a minute, but I kind of wanted to know, is there a school at McLaughlin? Is there a medical clinic at McLaughlin? Are there work training opportunities at McLaughlin? What is life there like for... I know there's two populations there, mm-hmm. but so can you spell that out just a little bit?
Sure. We do have school services that are provided by Anchorage School District. So we have school teachers that come in and they work on both the detention population and the treatment population. We do have on-site medical facilities and nursing staff on, not 24 hours, but during the day, but also on call at night to respond to any medical questions. We are not a medical facility, but we certainly will get them to medical facilities if they need. We do have a doctor that is contracted weekly to do sort of the preventative or routine appointments within the kids that are residing at the facility. And those are mostly for emergency services and more routine stuff for the kids that are in treatment.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We need to take a break. But I was just sort of wondering, John had talked a little bit about what life is like. It sounds like reprogramming a lot, like earning points and getting benefits by showing your behavior. And I wondered if that's a picture you can paint, but maybe not. I don't know. Do you know what I'm talking
about? I think he's right. Sure. We have kids, I like it to not sitting in the hospital waiting for the doctor to come. We engage the kids. They get up and have meals. It's an organized, structured activity to keep everybody safe. There's some in detention. We don't do any treatment programming because these kids are what we call pre-adjudication and mm-hmm. reserve all the rights that John was talking about. But we do education groups with that population. We do some relaxation, therapeutic kind of stuff to help with anxiety with some mm-hmm. of the kids that are there, and fun activities sometimes to, you know, when they're needed. And then on the treatment side, there's other things that go on treatment wise on those sides.
Could a high school student keep up with their studies
yes.
while they're going through
yes.
this process?
Yes.
So that doesn't necessarily mean they're derailed academically.
They're not derailed, but there's no question that from a trauma perspective, it's not. You know, it's not a relaxation, you know, be able to study everything. They have time, but, you know, there is no question that it is traumatic for kids to be in a locked setting.
Yeah.
The school, I don't know how much time you have, but the school in McLaughlin is, they use APEX. It's an online school. The teachers, I think, uniformly really like it. That to work there, I've heard some describe it's like the best kept secret of the Anchorage School District.
Really?
Well, all disciplines handled by someone else.
Yes.
And
maybe you can focus on the teaching, right?
Yeah, right. But the teaching is like kid at a computer with a teacher there to help sort of manage the computer and answer questions, mm-hmm. and every kid's at a different level.
Mm-hmm.
So there it is not the traditional like high school classroom.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
They do have a lot of, you know, in the detention unit side, they have like basketball tournaments and other, you know, the groups that Heidi was just talking about. I mean, it's everything from religious based to like sort of, you know, like proper sex relations with people to like, you know, substance abuse. None of them are treatment in that it's all educational. They're
mm-hmm.
like, you know, telling kids about things, except I think the religious based ones are on Sundays. People come in and interact more.
So it's not a one-on-one sort of counseling
setting.
No,
but there is that too. There can be that too.
Mm-hmm.
And so although it's not a treatment environment, it's not treatment itself, I think of it as like a therapeutic environment. It's a stable environment, and there's rules there.
Mm-hmm.
So you're hearing me talking a lot of favorable things about McLaughlin,
mm-hmm.
and that's because I go to the conferences and I hear about other detention facilities across the country that are just horrific.
Not like McLaughlin.
Right. And so, you know, not like McLaughlin. It's mm-hmm. still jail, and I still fight to get the kids out, and they all hate being in jail. But you asked about the environment.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. All right. Well, we do need to take a little break, so stay with us. You're listening to Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska, and I'm Kathleen McCoy.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska. Our topic today is juvenile justice, and we have a prosecutor and a public defender. We have Heather Nobrega from the prosecutor's office and John Bernitz from the public defender's office, and we have Heidi Redig, who is a chief probation officer. And we, you know, we're just trying to lay out the landscape. If you're not involved with juvenile justice, you might not know a whole lot about what's different about it. We decided to start the second half hour talking something about very unique to justice, to juvenile justice, which is a great lack of transparency and the challenges to that and the benefits to that. Why don't I start with you, Heather? Explain the lack of transparency,
sure.
why it exists, and then maybe the challenges that you see in it.
So the juvenile justice system, the point of this system, and actually I'm going to read you right from the statute, which it says the goals and purposes of the juvenile delinquency section says, the goal of this chapter is to promote a balanced juvenile justice system in the state, to protect the community, impose accountability for violations of law, and equip juvenile offenders with the skills needed to live responsibly and productively. And then it goes to list about 14 separate kind of purposes of the chapter. But the juvenile justice system, in order to help, I think it's a restorative justice program. And the goal is to hold offenders accountable, juvenile offenders accountable, but also not have necessarily their criminal activities as juveniles, as we discussed, who, when their brains are not fully formed, follow them the rest of their lives. So these are confidential proceedings. They're not found anywhere in the court system. You can't go down to the courthouse and look up a juvenile offender's, you know, criminal case file. And one of the frustrations from the public's point of view is you see police reports and police things in the news and
coverage.
You see news coverage. Thank you. I'm having a brain lapse here at the word I was looking for.
Headlines.
Thank you. You see headlines in the news and you see that a, you know, 16-year-old was arrested.
Something bad happened.
Or a 15-year-old was arrested, and that's it. That's all you hear. Or you see in the news there was a very widely spread video that made it into the media and all over the national media even. I don't know if it made it over the national media, but it certainly made it over the nation because we were getting phone calls at the DA's office from all over the lower 48.
And roughly the video was just...
It was an assault of multiple girls assaulting one particular
girl.
Female.
Okay. I remember that.
And nothing was heard about that, of course, because it's a confidential matter. So we were getting calls from all over the country saying, why aren't you doing anything when they don't know what we've done because we can't talk about it? So... from the aspect of the public not understanding that things really do happen, that APD does investigate these crimes and they do arrest people under the age of 18 for committing serious crimes. And you may see in the headline that someone was arrested and it was a juvenile, and that's all you're going to know. And that's all you ever will know.
And you can't go down to the courthouse and decide to find it and sit in it.
Correct.
It's closed.
Correct.
I think only the victim can be.
The victims can be present. A victim advocate can be present on behalf of the victims. Yes, absolutely. The victims have every right to be at every hearing.
But the general public does not.
Correct.
Can I comment on that?
Yes, you sure can.
Shockingly enough, John Nitz wants to comment.
It's important. I mean, I sort of want to sell the juvenile justice system. It's like a pearl we have, or an amazing system we have. You know, we all love our kids. We all get mad at kids that, you know, do mean things to our kids or do mean things to us. But the whole point of having a separate system, I mean, we didn't always have a separate system. It used to be that kids were treated as adults a long, long time ago. I mean, just because there was no reason not to. But then we discovered that, you know, or we came to the conclusion that they are kids and that we do want them to be rehabilitated and we want to give them every chance to succeed, in part because our kids, but also because it keeps the society safe. I mean, the best way to, if a kid does a robbery, like when they're 16, is to fix them.
Make an adjustment.
Yeah, deliberately using a non-clinical word to fix them so that then when they're, you know, 19, they have a job and they pay taxes.
Right, and life goes on.
Yeah, life goes on. And so part of that means that, you know, if you is keeping their misconduct secret. But the whole point of keeping it secret is to help them with their rehabilitation, which actually keeps us all safer.
In the long run, I guess you're saying, if they don't offend again.
Yeah. Otherwise, you know, then you look up the 13-year-old who, like, you know, did something, and then when they're 20, they're still having a hard time getting a job, and so then they do some other criminal activity as adults.
They never get.
They don't get the second chance. I mean, you really, it's a real second chance.
Uh-huh.
Now, having said that, the statutes that protect privacy have a lot of holes in them. But but the idea that you give young humans a second chance is a really special, civilized, developed idea that we adopt, both because it's a good thing to do and also because it really helps us keep ourselves safer in the long run.
Well, the other thing I wanted to make clear, which I'm sure it probably is clear, but I just want to make sure, is we talked a lot before the break about what happens at the facilities and the programs that are at the facilities. But a lot, as you heard the numbers, you know, there's very few numbers of juveniles who are actually in these institutionalized facilities. Majority then of those are being treated out in the community. And we're linking them to services in the community. And we're linking them to mental health services, to substance abuse treatment out in the community, to, you know, family therapy, whatever they might need. So a huge portion of that is actually community-based. And we're not dealing with them at the institutions, but we are trying to help them stay at home and deal with that in the community. And hopefully then kind of help redirect and address the issues that are causing them to come in contact with the juvenile justice system, and hope that then once we get those things in place, that will not happen in the future.
Right. I mean, I thought you were making or suggesting that we were at some sort of risk because the public never knows how these things turn out or what the what the penalties were, because they're just not, we're trying to give these kids a second chance. Are you at all saying that you think the community is at any risk because so much of this rehabilitation is going on out in the community? No, not at all. Okay.
Trust me, if they were risky kids, they would not be out in the community. We would be dealing with the high-risk kids.
Okay.
In a more structured setting, so to speak.
A very structured setting. I'm going to use our phone numbers for our audience in case they have questions about the juvenile justice system or had an experience with it or want to ask a question. In Anchorage, that is 550-8433. Statewide, it's 1-888-353-5752, and we can take an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. Okay, did we deal with the issue of lack of transparency sufficiently? Do you think we can move on?
Yes.
Okay.
It will not be transparent, period.
You won't know. And because of that, maybe a young person's life takes off in a better direction. For this segment, I was sort of wanting to say, how's Alaska doing based on national trends? One of the big national trends is that numbers have been dropping dramatically in juvenile facilities across the country, like something like 50%. I saw Alaska's number was down. And I guess I'm going to ask John about this. Why is that the trend? Is it because we're learning more about how to redirect youth, or we just are getting more civilized, or what? What do you think?
I'm not sure about the short-term trend, but I know there's a couple things that led to less people being detained at McLaughlin, and those were both the high and the low, scraping them off. So, there used to be a lot more kids going through McLaughlin, and then now they're being referred for very, very minor infractions, and they're being referred to youth court.
Mm-hmm.
So that's part of the 80% that I think Heidi was talking about that are deferred. So those people, they come in, and she should say more about this because they don't meet me. They come in, they meet a probation officer. They said a contract of something to do, and part of that can be going through youth court. And I think youth court didn't exist about, 10, 15 years ago?
Oh, yeah, youth court, yeah.
Yeah, youth court. So that takes off the low ends, right? They're no longer
so they
in
would
the
be
system.
Shoplifting, are we things like that? Or
yeah.
It's usually typically shoplifting, maybe some minor property damage, even sometimes marijuana in school. They might redirect those to youth court.
So then on the high end, and this is more dramatic, in 1996 they passed an auto waiver legislation, which means, sorry for the technical term.
Automatic waiver is what you're, not automobile waiver.
Right, exactly. Automatic waiver. So waiver, it's another legal term. It means transferring the child from juvenile court to adult court. Sometimes in other jurisdictions it's called transfer. So in 1996 they changed the law. And so for the kids who are over 16, who have the most serious crimes, just based on the accusations, the charges themselves, they go to adult jail.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like the higher, more serious cases were taken away from McLaughlin.
These are things like murder.
Yeah, like murder. Right, uh-huh. Exactly.
Really big.
Or, second robbery, murder.
Or repeated
robbery
serious.
First degree. Yeah. First degree robbery.
Uh-huh.
Right.
What is first degree robbery? Sorry.
It's an A felony.
It's a class A felony.
Does it mean a gun was used?
A weapon or a threat? Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
It doesn't always have to be a gun, but yes.
Or some weapon.
Yes.
Or threat.
Appearance of having a gun, threatening that you have a gun. You don't have to physically see it.
But yeah. Threatening it. So okay.
So you're going to ask me what I think of the automatic waiver statute?
Sure. Okay,
thank
John.
Thank you. I won't be very long. It was just...
we don't believe you. Go ahead.
It's just... I feel like... I think it's the worst thing we have in the juvenile justice system now. Before you had automatic waiver, you had what's called discretionary waiver. So the worst of the worst kids would go, who did the worst crimes in a very little time before they turned 18, would go before a judge, and the judge would say, you know what? You're really bad. We're going to send you to adult court. We're going to punish you as an adult.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they never see a judge. At the same time, the best kids, the ones that, for whatever reason, for their personality or for the facts of the crime itself, everyone would agree should be rehabilitated, should stay in juvenile court. Let's say everyone, my worst critics of me, Heather, would agree to this. So then those are the people that if they're over 16 and the crime is of certain type, then they are automatically placed in adult court without ever going before a judge and without having any recourse to the judicial system.
system to go back to juvenile court. Mm-hmm. So it takes the best kids, the ones that are most likely to be rehabilitated, and eliminates any discretion for them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why, that's my...
Why did it change?
It changed because what happens, I think, a lot in criminal law, there's one specific case and there's a lot of momentum behind when there's one specific case. And so a lot of people end up suffering because of one specific dramatic case.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Heather, do you have any thoughts about that on the other side?
I have a lot of thoughts. Whether or not I will share them all on the radio are two different things.
Right.
I can tell you, and I know that Mr. Burnett knows this, even though it is an automatic waiver, and it's automatic in that if it's these certain type of offenses and they are charged with those offenses in district court, basically, they are charged as adults. But we can also make the decision, we being the prosecutors, make the decision to charge them with lesser offenses and keep them at McLaughlin.
Mm-hmm.
And we often do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's
so you would say there's still
it's
some
a case,
discretion.
It's a, there is discretion. With anything that comes into our office, there's discretion on our charging decisions. When we review the police reports, you know, can we prove our screening decisions are beyond a reasonable doubt. If we cannot prove this case beyond a reasonable doubt, or we don't believe that at trial, we're not charging these cases. We're declining these cases. And we decline quite a bit because that is an extremely high standard. But for these juvenile cases that come in on a robbery in the first degree and are 16 years old, DJJ and our office will confer and decide what we believe is in the best interest of this particular case and this particular minor. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Burnett can attest to the fact that we have not waived a number of juveniles.
You know, I actually did an Arctic Entry talk on this type of thing, and she's right. There's a lot of cases where the state, the prosecutor on its own may exercise its discretion to charge a lower crime so the kid's not automatically placed in adult court. But this gets us right back to In re Gault, because unless you have the procedures or the due process involved there, if you have a decent prosecutor like Heather, things can work well. But you can't trust the individual. You need to have the processes mm-hmm. in place. That's why you need to be able to take it to a neutral and detached judge
mm-hmm.
to make your case, the adversary system. And it doesn't mean that the defense always wins, of course, but they get to go and say, you know what? The prosecution who thinks this guy should be in adult court is wrong, and here's why. We know this, this. That's mm-hmm. the whole way the criminal justice system mm-hmm. works, is adversarial, at least in this country.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it is, having said that, it is really nice to have opponents like Heather and like other people over in the DA's office that do the right thing and for the right case, but it's still a bad law because you're trusting that any individual person in the moment at their personal discretion makes the right decision rather than having it being transparent, and that's why.
Okay. We got that out.
Moving along.
Okay. We're going to throw our numbers out one more time, 550-8433 in Anchorage, or you can email us at hometown@alaskapublic.org. We had a caller come through, but we lost him, but he was asking about juveniles and sex crimes. And John, in our earlier discussions, you had some advice for youth along this line. So what do you want to say about juveniles and sex crimes?
You know, it is, it's just really, it's very hard to navigate the world of becoming an adult and having a healthy sex life. And it's just, I've seen a lot of tragedies on all sides for people that have gone astray in this. So I have very simple advice. Never talk to the police and always keep your text messages. And that's it. I mean, if the police want to talk to you, you do two things. You ask for a lawyer and you ask for your parents, regardless of if you're embarrassed mm-hmm. by it.
That's all the advice you have, really?
Well, our engineer let me know that the caller actually has slightly different. He was interested in sex offenders not being in school, but we didn't get the full question.
All right. So sex offenders not being in school.
He wants them out of his school.
I don't know what advice I'd have for them. I mean, if there's any time a kid's – it's the same thing with all the juvenile justice system. The statistics are just blatantly clear and obvious that if you are a child and you do a sex offense and you're caught, the recidivism rate is incredibly low. You never do it again because it's a boundary issue. You don't know that you're not supposed to do it and then you learn. That's completely different from an adult pedophile where it's more of a compulsion, which uh-huh. I'm not going to make any –
Yeah,
of the year,
right,
but the recidivism rate is a little bit higher, or so people think.
Mm-hmm.
So what you want to do with kids who are accused of inappropriately touching someone else is you want to give them treatment. And that's education, and it's mm-hmm. letting them talk about it and see if that's ever happened to them and work out their problems in a safe way. Uh-huh. Sometimes that treatment is in McLaughlin. Sometimes the treatment is at residential treatment. And sometimes it's at home.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's at home, the kids are put back in the school when the treatment process thinks it's appropriate and the school knows about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if I have advice for how to get, it almost seems like a little bit vigilantism. Like if a kid's been treated and never going to hurt anyone else, it's sort of like, why would you want him mm-hmm. out of your school?
Mm-hmm. Heather, do you have anything to add?
No, I do not. Nothing. Have
Heidi, nothing.
Topic.
Nothing to add. All right. All right. So let me think. What other things did I want to talk? Oh, school vandalism. That was something we talked about. When young people get involved in, I don't know, burning down playgrounds, accidentally or otherwise, who's responsible? And I think the point we were trying to make in our earlier discussion was that where does responsibility go? It goes to the child, but it goes to the parent too, right?
Correct. Parents actually, when it comes to, so one of the things about the juvenile justice system is restoring the victim,
mm-hmm.
which includes restitution. So the victim is made whole, and whether that victim is your neighbor down the street, or it's the Anchorage School District who's lost an entire playground because of burning it down. So parents, the juvenile justice system says not only is the minor responsible for restitution, but he's also responsible with any other co-defendants and also parents. The parents are also responsible.
So we're talking some money here.
Well, there
could
it depends on the offense, yes.
Mm-hmm.
The school district playgrounds are very expensive playgrounds because of the material they have to use. So anytime there is a fire at a, we're talking in tens and 20 thousands of dollars
mm-hmm.
at the school district playgrounds. So.
Right. So that's something for parents to think about or adults who are responsible
yes.
for. And actually, we're getting a lot of calls here. We've got Thomas from Anchorage. Welcome to Justice Alaska. Thomas, do you have a question or a comment?
I had a huge collection of old National Geographics, and I took them over there, and I ride my bike past there a lot, and I see the basketball court, but I never see any kids out there, and that makes me sad, because I think even though kids still got to learn how to play, and are there ways that the community can contribute to McLaughlin in ways like that?
Are there ways that people can give books? I don't know.
So there's absolutely ways, and I can give out my contact name to do that for donations for things that go on our units.
Mm-hmm.
But I do want to just speak to the basketball. I think the court that he's seeing isn't currently being used, but we do have a court within the facility outside that they can't see.
Oh, okay.
That is hidden.
So they are playing basketball.
Yeah, it's a new one that enables them to be out a lot more than we had in the old days because it's right outside of the detention unit. And so kids can be in and out, and whereas
okay.
before, what he's seen is one we had to take everybody to, and then we also have indoor ones, so they're still playing basketball.
Okay.
But definitely, you can give my contact information. I can put him into contact with who.
I'll add yours to alaskapublic.org under Hometown Alaska, and then people can find you if they want to make a donation to McLaughlin.
Absolutely, and we also have a volunteer program. If there's folks out in the community that want to become mentors or want to learn about what we do or add to the units, we have a foster care program for grandparents. So we have lots of rooms for volunteers that would be supervised, and depending on what their likeness was and what they like to whether it's activities, visitation, et cetera,
mm-hmm. okay.
they can also contact me at that number, and I'll get them in the place with the right people.
Kind of an interesting way to take some responsibility for what's going on in your community. We have another caller. Bill, you're listening to Justice Alaska. What's your question?
Hi. My question has to do with the way children are treated in the U.S. Versus other countries. I'm going to be sending my son to a boarding school in the U.K., And it's fascinating when you look at schools here in the U.S. versus the U.K. or other parts of Europe where here children are supposed to behave like little adults, and we have this sort of one strike and you're out policy, whereas looking at this boarding school in the U.K., and it's an elite boarding school. It's not for troubled children or anything. It's for the exact opposite, but there boys are supposed to act like teenage boys, and there seems to be a lot more flexibility built into the system that children get to make mistakes and learn from them, rather than here in the U.S. where it's one strike and you're out forever.
Well, I'm not sure that our guests could comment on what's going on in the UK. So I don't know. I mean, it's your observation. Do you have anything to say, Heather?
I will do a fact-finding mission for you and go to the UK and do some research. Okay, but other than that, no, I do not have
you'd,
any
You'd like
any
a travel
comments.
Voucher to, yes. to do the research. I'm just not sure that we can comment on it. I don't know whether One Strike You're Out seems to have kind of
I think I can comment from a local perspective here in Anchorage is that I've been doing this now, just hit 25 years. And when I started in this system, it was much more closed than it is now. More, you know, even though it is when we talk about no transparency, I mean, it was like you didn't know what happened behind those walls at all. You never heard about us. You didn't. We weren't, you know, out there in the community looking for services. It was just a different time because that's what we did. Nobody was allowed to know who these kids were. And I think through that process, when I was involved in the reentry side of the house with kids coming out of our institutions, that was my primary job. You know, let's talk the school district back into all the work that these youth have done. So I can get them back into school, especially the younger ones. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the Anchorage School District has done an amazing job over the years, opening their arms with our support staff and our probation officers being there, mentoring the kids, supporting the families, being there. That there's not a lot of times, you know, even in the recent years, that if the child and the family does the work with the other community, the parts of the community working with them, that we're not able to get them back in. Mm-hmm. I can only attest to in the old days, it was really a hard mission. And now Anchorage School District does a fantastic job
and
of
what was that about?
Taking
was
them
that
back
people
in.
People getting out of their silos and talking to each other? Or was there a new sort of philosophy that came to play?
I think it was a combination. I think in the old days, we didn't as we were a different part of the division than we are now. But, you know, we couldn't talk about the kids. Therefore, how could you go back to the school and do that? You know, where now there's other ways. We don't need to share everything with them. We, you know, the school trusts that we're doing what we need to do and they're doing what they need to do. Mm-hmm. And the communication is there. Maybe the cell phones added to that. They can get a hold of us quickly. I mean, there's all kinds of things that have changed
over time.
And it's building that trust. And the biggest thing is building in the capacity with the community supervision issues and having real loyal and positive staff to help help them and be that unconditional person, as John definitely is with his kids, unconditional people that, all right, we're going to respond to what just happened, and then we're going to get you back out there again if their behavior allows us or, you know, they haven't, you know, been involved in something that's so horrific.
So serious. Yeah. Well, we have about a minute. Does anybody have something they want to leave people to think about juvenile justice? Or, I mean, I think that story was actually kind of, I was trying not to leave people in the depths of despair. Mm-hmm. But I don't think we did that anyway. But the idea that it's evolved so much to be more rehabilitative than it maybe originally was. But, John, anything you want? Don't forget Galt, right? You want people to go read Galt in the Wikipedia.
Well, I guess I just want to say that I've been doing this for a while, not 25 years, but maybe like 13, I believe. And it never ceases to amaze me that people are more than their crimes. They're more than the worst possible day that they've had in their lives. And that's what we need to see.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a good note to end on. So you can hear the music.
It's like the Oscars. You have been cut off on your acceptance speech, John. The music has started.
All right. So I want to thank Heather Nubrega from the Anchorage Prosecutor's Office, John Bernitz from the Public Defender's Office, and Heidi Reddick, Chief Probation Officer from the Division of Juvenile Justice, and our callers and listeners. I'll be back as your Hometown Alaska host next week when we'll be talking about the 4th Avenue Theater, its status, and its future. Find us on the web at alaskapublic.org. Dave Waldron is our audio engineer. Thanks for joining us today on Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.